Reading from Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 to 7, and page 690 in the Bibles. I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you, what am I going to do with my vineyard? I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for the righteousness, but heard cries of distress.
Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing, surely the great houses will become desolate and fine mansions left without occupants. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine. A homer of seed will yield only an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, pipes and tambourines and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the works of his hands. Therefore, my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Those of high rank will die of hunger, and the common people will be parched with thirst. Therefore, death expands its jaws, opening wide its mouth. Into it will descend their nobles and masses with all their brawlers and revelers. So people will be brought low and everyone humbled, the eyes of the arrogant humbled. But the Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice, and the holy God will be proved holy by his righteous acts. Then sheep will graze as in their own pasture, lambs will feed among the ruins of the rich. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit, and wickedness as with cart ropes. To those who say, let God hurry, let him hasten his work so that we may see it. The plans of the Holy One of Israel, let it approach, let it come into view so that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe, but deny justice to the innocent.
Thank you very much, Anne and Lloyd, for reading that. Let's keep that open in front of us. We're going to look at that chapter of the Bible together and think about what God is saying to us. And the title is A Society That Chooses Its Own Morality. A society that chooses its own morality. We're all born into a society, and we grow up in it, and we live the way everyone else lives in that society. So, for example, I guess most of us here eat rice with a fork. So I had a takeaway meal last night, and there was rice, and I got a fork out, and I ate it with a fork. But there'll be some people who grew up in different places who would find it very strange to eat rice with a fork and would find it much easier to do it with chopsticks. Or they might come from another part of the world where normally people eat rice with their bare hands, and that seems natural and the obvious thing to do. And there are bigger differences between societies than how you eat rice. There are differences in the way that we think about money, about sex and relationships, about drinking alcohol, about justice, about the rich and the poor. And in all those things, we tend to just copy our friends. We learn from a young age at school, from the ideas that our teachers have. Sometimes they don't even notice that they're teaching us how to think and how to live in those ways. Or we take things in from our social media bubbles and the people that we hear from there, or from the movies that we're watching and the TV programs we're watching. We don't even notice we're learning it, but we're getting a way of living and a way of thinking from our society. It's a kind of brainwashing, really. But when a society chooses its own idea of right and wrong, how do we know that our society is getting it right? How do we know that our society is not causing harm in the things that seem normal and obvious to us? Because sometimes we look at other parts of the world or other times in history and we see what they were doing and we think, well, that's terrible. That's harmful. I really hate that, but how do we know that that's not true for us as well? Well, the great thing about Jesus is that he invites people from many different societies, all different societies, he invites people to come and join his society, a whole new society, a whole new and better way of thinking and living. And he teaches us and shows us the best way. Not only that, he helps us and changes us so that we can live that way. So society around us never stops brainwashing us for most of the hours of the day, but it only takes just a little of Jesus. Often for most of us, that's just a little bit of the Bible each day. The rest of the day is secular society. Once a week, listening to a sermon. The rest of the week, listening to society. But sometimes that is all it takes from Jesus to win over our hearts. We learn to trust him, to love him, and to obey him. And you see the difference in the way that we live our lives. Well, Isaiah is speaking to the society of his own time, the city of Jerusalem, in chapter 5 of Isaiah, and he's showing them what was so bad about their society. And I would sum up the first part of Isaiah 5 like this. God gave so much and gets so little. That's verses 1 to 7. God gave so much and gets so little. Let's read some of it again. So the start of chapter 5. I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. You see, it's a love song. I will sing of the one I loved. It's a love song. Once a year we have the Eurovision Song Contest. Did anybody watch that last night? Just wave at me if you watched it. Anyone stay up late for the results? We have this tradition. We love to listen to songs and sing songs. And I suspect in Judah they had something a bit like that. Often a big business in Judah, in Jerusalem, was to grow grapes and make wine. And when the grapes were grown and picked and the wine was made, people got together and they celebrated and they drank some of the wine and they sang songs. And Isaiah decides, well, his preaching is not really getting through to some of them. He's going to enter a song for their little kind of annual song contest. And he enters this one. And it starts like any good love song starts. And he's actually going to make it a song about God. But he doesn't tell you that until the end of the song. So they're all listening and loving this song and really getting into it. Because it's a song about people just like them, people who grow grapes and build vineyards. And this guy who's growing the grapes, he does everything you should do. He does it all right. Now, it's a lot of work to grow grapes. I don't know if you know this. The first year, you dig up the side of a hill, and you have to clear away a lot of stones. If you've been to Israel, you'll know the ground is full of stones. You've got to clear them all away. That takes a long time. And you dig it up and you find the very best vine that you can and you select it carefully and you plant it. And while it's growing, there's still lots to do. You've got to build walls and hedges around it to keep out the thieves. Some of the thieves have two legs, some of them have four legs. You've got to watch out for them. So you build a tower so you can be up high on the tower and watch and see the thieves coming and protect your vineyard so that it can grow. And then finally, and often this would be about year three, finally, you get to go and see the fruit. And the listeners to this song, they're excited. They're thinking, this is going to be amazing, this fruit. They're probably picturing it a bit like this. Lovely, lush grapes will have been grown. They can be turned into nice, crisp, delicious wine that you can sit and enjoy and sing songs in your vineyard. And this guy's done everything right. So how's it going to go? Verse 2, he dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. And the people listening to the song are really sort of surprised to hear that. What a sad story. What use is a vineyard full of bad grapes? Can't make any wine out of that. He's done everything right. Makes no sense. And Isaiah says this to them, verse 3, "Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it?" He did everything right. He did everything he possibly could to grow these wonderful grapes and have this great wine. Why, when I looked for grapes, why did it yield only bad? And the listeners are really with him on that. They're really on his side because they're in this business and they know that he's done everything he possibly could. And at this point, they're with the singer, but it's only then when Isaiah gets to the end of the song that in the last line, he brings in a bit of a shock, a bit of a surprise. It turns out this song is about you and about God. God is the one growing the grapes, and you're the vineyard, and you're not producing anything good, even though he's done so much for you. Verse 7, "The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. He looked for justice but saw bloodshed, for righteousness but heard cries of distress." It even sounds like a song in the original language that Isaiah sang it in. Verse 7 reads a bit like this: "I looked for Mishpat and saw Mishpak. I listened for Siddaka and heard Sarka. They should have been fair, instead they kill each other. They should have done right, instead they cause pain and tears and crying out." Have you ever put a lot into something and got nothing back from it? I don't know if any of us play Minecraft or other games, and you've advanced through the games, you've put many hours into it, you've built some amazing thing, and you're really impressed with it, and then you've forgotten to save. Or something's gone wrong, and you have to go right back to the beginning and start all over again. You want to kick the computer. Or something more intense than that. You're in a relationship. You've given years of your life. You've been faithful and honest. You've built a home together and a family together, and then you discover that your partner was cheating on you, and they leave you, and it breaks your heart. And that is how God feels when he looks at society. He delighted in us. He said to us, "Here's the world. Don't spend it all at once. A lovely blue planet, crisp seas, wonderful trees, fantastic mountain views, great jokes to laugh at, music to enjoy. I've shown how much I care for you." And he says, "What more can I do for you?" Verse 4, "What more could have been done than I've done?" God gave so much, and yet society gives God back so little. We give God bad fruit, verse 2. It yielded only bad fruit, verse 4. Why did it yield only bad? Well, that's the first part of what Isaiah is saying. God gave so much and gets so little. And then he takes us through some of the bad fruit in his own society, in his own city of Jerusalem at the time, from verse 8 up to really verse 23, the part that Anne read for us. And he uses this word woe. Woe, it sort of means alas. What a shame, what a pity, so tragic. It's like a kind of crying emoji. It's woe. Woe to you for what you've done. So verse 8, woe to you who? Verse 11, woe to those who? Verse 18, woe to those who? Verse 20, woe to those who? Verse 21, woe to those who? Verse 22, woe to those who? So all these different kinds of bad fruit in their lives. We're going to sum it up with just three. Firstly, greedy gain. Greedy gain in verses 8 to 10. Let me read verse 8. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. The rich just want more and more. They have one house, but that's not enough. They want another house. They want a bigger house. They want more and more land, and they can, so they buy more. And other people are squeezed out. There's no space left for anybody else. They have to work for other people on their land, but they have nothing of their own. No one can afford to live there because of all the second homes, all the big houses that are empty. People have gone out to work. They're just like bedrooms and bedrooms and massive great sitting rooms. But the lights are all off. There's no one at home. And meanwhile, there are families that are crammed together, like six of them sharing a bedroom with no space of their own. There's nothing wrong with money in the Bible. With wealth, that's not a bad thing in the Bible, but the love of money is a real problem, the root of all evil, according to 1 Timothy. The root of all evil. The more we want it, the more we'll take, no matter what the impact on other people. I wonder if that sounds familiar to us. I wonder if society today is a little like that. If the wealthy have more space than they could possibly use, while others have no space for themselves. God gave so much and gets so little. Greedy gain, verses 8 to 10. And then chasing drink, verses 11 to 17. Chasing drink. So verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, pipes and tambourines and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. Now, alcohol is a good gift from God. After all, this chapter has a story about God being someone who grows grapes and makes wine. It's not a bad thing. All of the things that God made are good things, but like all of God's gifts, we have got a tendency to abuse them and treat them badly. And just as money is fine, but the love of money is a problem, it's the same with wine and alcohol. It's not wrong until we love it too much. Do you see these people in verse 11? They're getting up early in the morning to run after it, to chase after it. This is what's driving them. They're staying up late at night to indulge in it. They don't know when to stop. In fact, they're really focused on their parties. It's not just a glass or two with friends. They're living for the weekend, for self-indulgence. They really take a lot of trouble to make sure they've got everything right for their parties. They've got the most amazing music and all the best drinks, but they pay no attention to what God is doing. Much more interested in their drink and their parties than they are in God. No regard for the deeds of the Lord, verse 12. They know their Spotify playlist much better than the Bible. After Saturday night, they're too hungover on Sundays to pay any attention to a sermon, the last thing they'll be doing on Sunday morning. They're chasing drink. Greedy gain. Chasing drink, verses 11 to 17. And then clever excuses, verses 18 to 23. Clever excuses, that's what they're in trouble with God for. Verse 18. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes. How do you get a big, wicked, evil thing into a society? As I say, it's a bit like kind of pulling it along, dragging along some massive, heavy thing with ropes like you'd pull a cart. But what is the rope that you're pulling with? What are the cords that you're pulling with? How do you get it there? Well, they're cords of deceit. You get it into society by lying, by distorting the truth. You have to convince yourself and convince other people that wrong is right and that bad is good and that harmful is helpful. You have to have a kind of moral crusade and a campaign in favour of something until people really start to call it a good thing when actually God has said it's a bad thing. Chapter 5, verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. They think they're really clever. In their own opinion, they think they know better than God. But what they've done is they've turned values on their head. They've taken things that God says are bad and convinced people they're good. They've taken things that people think God says is good and convinced people that it's bad. This was happening in Jerusalem. This is what society does. There's a pastor called Joe Wright who was asked to pray at the opening of a Senate meeting in his part of America, an organization that passes legislation. And people were used to a pastor showing up at the beginning, a preacher would show up at the beginning and pray something. It was usual kind of boring general stuff. People didn't pay much attention. But they got a shock that day when he came because he prayed a heartfelt confession based on verse 20. Those who call evil good. He confessed that as a society we have done that. He prayed about how people reject the Bible and call it pluralism, how people worship other gods and call it multiculturalism, how we are sexually immoral and call it alternative lifestyles and being open-minded, about how people exploit the poor and call it a lottery that's there for charity, how people take the lives of children who are not yet born and call it respecting equality and promoting choice. About how people neglect to discipline children and call it building self-esteem, or abuse power and call it politics, or treat the poor badly and call it ambition. How people normalize pornography and call it freedom of expression. Well, they didn't ask him back to pray again the next week. Some of them have walked out halfway through the prayer. And you and I might feel a similar way. We might also find ourselves a little bit uncomfortable with Pastor Joe Wright and his prayer. Because after all, this is not the way he's praying. It jars with Cambridge. It jars with the kind of society and values that are normal for us in the West that we just take for granted and assume must be right. But before we argue back with him, and before we dismiss what he is saying, just notice that there is one last woe that is mentioned here. And it's actually not in this chapter, it's in the next chapter, which we'll look at more next week. Chapter 6, verse 5. Woe to me, I cried. Even a preacher can say, woe to me. None of us is above this danger. We're all of us caught up in this trap of society. Even committed Christians who teach God's word to others need to say, woe to me. How have I been influenced by the society that I belong to? And how has that led me to call evil good and justify wrongdoing? God gave so much and gets so little, and here's some of the bad fruit in his society in Jerusalem. And then he finishes with this: God's anger can be turned away. That's verses 24 to 30. God's anger can be turned away. Let's read verse 25. Therefore, the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised and he strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the street. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. We've had a series of woes, and we also have a series of therefores in this chapter. When society is so terrible, God warns them and warns them, but in the end, there will be a therefore. There'll be consequences, there'll be an outcome, there will be removed and replaced. This is what happened in Isaiah's time. Jerusalem has rejected God, society's turned against God, not in name, they still claimed to be believers in God, but in their lives, you could tell they weren't living for him. And a huge enemy nation is approaching to destroy Jerusalem, the nation of Assyria, great army, powerful army, rushing towards them and conquering all the nations in between Assyria and Jerusalem, one at a time. Chapter 5, verse 26, he, that's God, lifts up a banner for the distant nations, like a military flag that makes an army come. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the end of the earth. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. Jerusalem must have felt a little bit like Finland and Sweden, who suddenly very enthusiastic about joining NATO. And no wonder, they're seeing the huge might of Russia invading Ukraine, and everyone is thinking, well, will it be us next? And what can we do about that? And the whole world is suddenly paying attention. The Russian army, of course, are nothing compared to the Assyrian army. The Russian army seemed to be having a lot of trouble. The Assyrian army weren't having any trouble. They were just sweeping through place after place. But for Judah, their real problem is not the Assyrians. Their real problem is God. Because he's the one calling the Assyrian army. He wouldn't allow it to happen if their society stuck with him. But they're on their way because society has rejected God. He is the one calling the Assyrian army like whistling for a dog. Do you notice that in verse 26? He whistles for them and they come running. Sometimes if you're out for a walk and you see someone with a dog and the dog comes charging towards you and then you hear the owner notice and they whistle and the dog just turns around on the spot and races off to follow the owner. Unless, of course, it's my dog, in which case you'll see me in the distance whistling and calling, and the dog will look at me and look at you and decide it would be much more fun to jump up on you with its muddy paws than to come back to me. But God doesn't have that kind of problem. He just whistles and he can bring not only an army... Sorry, not only a dog, but an army. He can bring an international superpower from a long way away with all its military might, just with a whistle. Their real problem is God, and his hand is upraised. He will have a good, fruitful society. That's his plan. And he'll only tolerate wrong societies for so long. His stand is still upraised, but notice that it is in verse 25. His anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. It hasn't yet come down on Jerusalem. And in fact, what happened is that people listened to Isaiah and Micah and other preachers. And in the end, just in time, the city of Jerusalem cried out for God, to God for mercy and help, and asked for forgiveness. And the Assyrian armies made it all the way to the gates of Jerusalem, but weren't able to get in. And we're turned around again. His hand is raised. God's hand is raised. But still today, his anger can be turned away. The same hand that is raised to strike humanity was nailed to a cross all those years ago. That's why we're having the Lord's Supper this morning, to remind us that God's anger can be turned away. Yes, his anger burns fiercely, but his love burns even more fiercely. So much so that he would rather be the one to suffer and die for us so that we can be forgiven. And what he does is he invites us into a new society and fills that society with good fruit. Here's what Jesus said about it in John chapter 15. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. What a wonderful gift. To be like the branches of a grapevine. So long as we're still attached to Jesus, so long as the branch remains attached to the vine, there will be good fruit in our lives. The character of Jesus growing in us and changing us. We won't just have bad fruit. There's some bad fruit. We won't just have the bad fruit. The greedy gain will be changed into generous giving. We've been hearing about that. What a wonderful thing that St. Matthew's is financed by generous giving. Because that greedy gain of people have thought, well, I'm not going to keep expanding my property. I'm going to give some away so that people can hear about Jesus. We see it transformed into that good fruit. Greedy gain turned into generous giving. Chasing drink. And people who've lived like that come to Jesus and find that that Jesus satisfies in a way that drink never does. Drink always leaves you wanting more. Parties never really make you happy enough, but Jesus gives you something that isn't escapism, it's real. And it's forever. And he satisfies. People who no longer tangled up in those cords of deceit, not happy to accept whatever society believes, but trusting Jesus, listening to him and gradually discovering where they've been led astray and coming to see things the way that Jesus does. the fruit of Jesus in our lives. Here's what the New Testament says to describe it. Love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, gentleness, humility, and self-control. Well, let's be sure that we stay part of Jesus' society and that we remain in him.